Welcome to Nourish and Shine, where I talk with passionate leaders in the fields of nutrition, functional and integrative medicine, and wellness, providing inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and live a whole vibrant life starting now. Hey, this is Amy.
And Megan. And we had this wild idea that's now becoming a reality. We've created the Nourish Your Soul Retreat. If you're ready to give yourself the gift of turning inward in order to awaken all parts of you, to spend a day tapping into your creative, feminine power, intuition, and nature, and learn how to fully embody your knowing and capacity for healing,
this retreat is for you if you crave real connection with nature and other soulful women who are on a similar path to nourishing their mind, body, and soul. Join us for the Nourish Your Soul Retreat at the beautiful Twin Bluffs Farm in Stockholm, Wisconsin on September 7th, 2019 from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Check out the show notes for the link to our website and the full details. We hope to see you there. This is such a special episode. For this episode, I went out and talked with Tony of Sacred Blossom Herb Farm in person. I was able to tour around his incredible farm. And let me tell you, if you are ever in the area, I highly recommend contacting him to see if you could come on a tour. It is one of the most beautiful farms I have ever been to. He has prairies with plants that are mixed all together in dense polyculture, the way they'd grow in nature. It's something that you don't see very often. The way he grows herbs is so unique and beautiful and makes such a high quality product. I was just blown away by the whole experience. We walked around and tasted herbs as we were talking, and I was like, oh my gosh, these are the best herbs I've ever had, and in such a cool setting. So I definitely recommend checking out his website where you can find his three teas, Tiger, Angel, and Dream, and they are crafted from the herbs he grows right there on the farm. He uses a special drying process, which we'll talk a little bit about in the episode, but it really dries the herbs, preserving the color and the potency and the freshness, just like they're picked at the peak of their freshness. And he picks everything pretty much by hand, using just minimal tools, which I think is also so cool. His teas are seasonal, and when they sell out, they're gone. So I highly recommend checking out his website and trying some of his amazing teas. He says in the episode too, but I'll repeat it again, you can also find his teas in like 80 different grocery stores. So I hope you really, really enjoy this episode. We're gonna dive deep into polyculture, farming, growing teas, medicinal herbs, and so much more. Enjoy. Welcome to Nourish and Shine, Tony DiMaggio from Sacred Blossom Herb Farm. We are sitting here on his porch. It is beautiful and raining, and we just had the most amazing tour of the farm. But before we talk about that, I'd love Tony to talk about himself and just tell us a little bit about how you got into this.
I fell into farming by mistake one summer, kind of the wrong place at the wrong time. Before that, I was a travel bum. I was born in California, and then I grew up in Costa Rica. And went to university in Argentina to avoid tremendous student debt. That one is going to school for business administration. Had bizarre odd jobs from working for Shania Twain on a reforestation project on her, was it 4 or 8,000 acre farm in New Zealand. Worked for the former head of the Vietnamese secret police, consulting for his hotel, substitute school teaching in New Mexico, all sorts of bizarre little odd jobs. And one summer I'm traveling around and kind of ran out of money and ended up on a farm. Long story. And the owner of the farm goes, hey, you looking for a job? And I go, as a matter of fact, I am. That was Paul Otten. Paul had been farming at that point for 7 years. And he's an avid student of soil health and human health and where those two worlds intersect. And Paul taught me so much. I was his right-hand man for 6 years. And he really instilled in me this passion of farming for health, for my health, your health, and the health of the planet. So I worked for Paul for 6 years, doing 22 acres of fruits and vegetables. He grew fruits and vegetables because they're some of the most nourishing things you can consume. And I knew how much money I could expect to make, you know, growing cucumbers, and just wasn't going to be enough starting from zero to, you know, to get the farm and material thing you want to acquire in this life. So I traveled around for a couple of years and visited dozens of different specialty crop farms, all sorts of different things, and became very interested in herbs and herbalism. So I got a job on one of the larger diversified organic herb farms in the country and learned how it's done. And while I was doing that, I was looking at the products in the marketplace. And I saw the herbal tea market, the quality of the herbs was really pretty abysmal. And I thought I could do much better than what was already out there. So here we are.
Nice. That's amazing. And so we just took a tour around the farm just in time because now it's pouring. And the farm is incredible. So it's kind of spread out. You have everything kind of growing together. And polyculture is really important to you. And can you kind of talk about that? Because I was super impressed by how everything's together and how, like, you kind of, it's all together and growing well, but you have a, like, method to the madness too, right?
So the herbalists are always looking for wildcrafted herbs. Wildcrafted herbs are generally more potent because they grow up struggling, they grow up slower. It's two reasons. First of all, something like 30 to 80% of the plant's energy actually goes to feeding the soil. People think that soil comes from plants decomposing, but that's really just a small fraction of it. The plant absorbs energy from the sun, absorbs carbon from the air, and injects carbohydrates into the soil. And the plant is actually ordering up the minerals it needs in a symbiotic relationship with the biology in the soil. And what the plant needs in the morning is different than what it needs in the evening. And the plant needs when it's a month old is different than what it needs when it's 2 months old. So the plant will always adjust what it's injecting in the soil in order to absorb different things in return. And each plant is only able to access certain things. So by having that biodiversity above ground, it leads to biodiversity below ground, and all the plants are more able to absorb a wider range of nutrients, which is really critical when you're growing these medicinal compounds. If all you're focused on is your corn yield, you can do that with, you know, fewer nutrients. But if you're interested in echinacea or californine or one of these bizarre compounds we're going for, you want this, you know, this wide biodiversity. And then plants that struggle and grow more slowly are also going to be more potent. Just like a tree from a commercial pine plantation that might be mature in 25 years, they had all that space, they had all the fertilizer, and they just shot right up. And the cells are really big, and the cells are filled with water. They do the same thing with herbs. Generally, on industrial herb farms, the plants have tons of space, tons of water, tons of fertilizer, very rich soil, and things get really big, really fast. But they're not the same quality as plants that grow more slowly and struggle.
One of the things you say that I love about your teas is that they're, like, living. Like, they have that energy and a different energy than the most commonly available, like, commercial teas that you find. And can you speak more to that and, like, how your teas are different and why that's important?
So the difference is not only in the quality of the herbs that come out of the field, but everything after that as well. First of all, I harvest everything by hand. So every leaf and every flower that goes in is perfect. On big farms, they go through with giant mowers. They suck everything up, whether it's weeds or whatever, and then they have to grind everything up because they don't even know it's in it. So I start with just the best leaves and flowers. And then you saw in the herb dryer, I have a custom-built machine that me and an Amish neighbor welded up together that is designed for producing high, you know, just really gentle on the herbs. Most things go into a hammer mill on the industrial farms, and it creates a lot of heat and everything shatters. And it creates tons of surface area, and all that surface area oxidizes very quickly. So all my systems are set up, not just in the field, but also in processing to really maintain that living natural essence of the herbs. And that's why I package everything in the clear container. So you can see really, like, it's just night and day difference from anything you find in a tea bag.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think that the colors are so vibrant in your teas. And you can actually, like you said, see what's in there. Like, they're mostly in their whole form. I think just the taste of the tea, too, has a totally different energy to it. And it's so, we're drinking it right now, in fact. But it's like so, I don't know, it's so complex. And you really blend a lot of different things in your teas. And you have three main teas for 2019. And your teas are seasonal. So once you sell out, like, that's it, right?
That's correct. And it's always evolving. I'm done packaging the three teas I have now, Angel, Tiger, and Dream. And I won't do anymore. Starting with the production off this year's herbs, I'm going to do a new batch of teas. And always evolving. Right now I'm doing these clear plastic containers. And they go really great in stores. Every store, I've only been on this farm for, this is my fourth year. But we're already in about 80 grocery stores, which is really fantastic. Wow. And part of it's because I have these really fancy clear packages, but they're expensive. And I'm a big believer, like, let's cut all this marketing baloney and focus on, like, the absolute best quality product at a very competitive price. So I'm going to go to larger size bags. They're going to be biodegradable. And they're going to work out to about 25 cents per serving for people. So cheaper than a Coca-Cola, but infinitely better quality.
Wow. That's awesome. And when are you making that change?
Oh, bit by bit. I have 3,000 or so jars in inventory now. I figure that'll get me through about Christmas, and then we'll switch into new stuff.
Cool. And I know that health of people and the planet is super important to you. Can you talk about that? And also, can we tie that into the soil and, like, how soil is so important to human health?
So I've met plenty of people who think, oh, the earth's fine, we're not destroying the earth. These people haven't gotten out much. It's such a small planet we live on, and every last inch of it that's hospitable is covered in humans, teeming with human activity. You go to New York City and you think, oh, there's a lot of people here. That's nothing compared to every, you know, major cities in Europe and Asia. And there's so many people now, and, you know, it's that hockey stick population growth, just going up and up, and every last inch of land's being used. So I think these are critical times to move everything humanity does into, like, a sustainable mode. And if we don't, we're gonna go. So this sustainability is really, really key to me. And that's sustainability of, you know, using less plastic, using less fuel. But most important for me is soil conservation. When people came to the Midwest, when there was 8 feet of topsoil with 8% organic, now we're looking at about 2 feet of topsoil with about 2 to 3% organic. Before, you could rip down the prairie, throw in, you know, heavy feeding wheat year after year after year and get great yields. Now, man, you can't grow corn without fertilizer. No way. And one day there's going to be a hiccup in our petroleum supply. And that's what fertilizers are. They're fossil fuels products. And when we don't have the access to the fertilizer for a year, it's going to be a huge, huge issue. So let's start growing food sustainably now and having that biodiversity in the soil and ever increasing the amount of carbon, the organic matter in the soil, rather than depleting.
People are finally starting to kind of catch on to that. And you see this whole movement of people going towards more sustainable things or choices in their lives. I think in farming, though, you're still pretty unique as far as the polyculture goes. I know, at least in our area, there's so much monoculture. What are your thoughts on that?
One of the most revolutionary guys in soil science right now is named Gabe Brown. He has a huge farm in the central United States. I want to say Dakotas, North Dakota, South Dakota. And he basically grows mostly beef, also does cash crops, corn, soybeans. But he has done what they've always said is impossible. He's increased, he had the 2 feet of topsoil, the 2% organic matter, and now he has, I want to say, over 3.5 feet of topsoil, and he's up to like 6-7% organic matter. People said you couldn't build soil that quickly. And he's largely doing it through these diverse polyculture cover crops and then putting the cattle on that. So I think he's going to be a really, you know, what I do is so unique, the herbs, or is how many, you know, just maybe 1,000 acres, whatever, the herbs in the country, but of cattle and cash crop, there's millions of acres. And Gabe Brown is really a pioneering guy in how we can use these polycultures to improve our soil. And I think it's critical that we start on this now.
So I know you mentioned you have an herb mentor, and you kind of got into herb after being into more like larger scale farming. Can you talk about kind of your journey in learning about herbs and herbalism a little bit?
So after I worked vegetables and small fruits for 6 years, I traveled around for 2 years and visited many different types of specialty crop farm, figuring out what can I do as a small scale, undercapitalized guy and still compete. Farming for health, you know, herbs fit in really good with that. Sustainability, herbs, because there's less tillage, a lot of short-lived perennials fit in really good with that. Also, vegetables, which my background's in, you know, to get a head of broccoli the diameter of a dinner plate takes really almost unnatural soil conditions, like really pumped up soil. Herbs are natural wild plants, and they thrive in like your normal, you know, standard soil. I'm just producing leaves as opposed to these big old giant beets or, you know, these massive vegetables people are pulling out. So anyway, it just fits in with sustainability, healthy soils, healthy people, healthy planet. So I went and got a job on, you know, a very large herb farm. And yeah, also when I was working there, I apprenticed on a very small boutique herb farm, one of the probably the best herb farm in the country, where they have everything they grow pre-sold to just a few medical practitioners. And they grow everything. It looks more like a wild, you know, my field's kind of, you can tell what's going on. You've got to be a real expert to harvest in this guy's fields. but, you know, there's plenty of demand, and that's how he makes his livelihood with this, like, very specialty, like, premium medicinals grown in wild with a lot of struggle, even more so than what I have going on. So I learned a lot from him, taking a lot of classes, read lots of books on herbalism and the practical uses of herbs. Matthew Wood is near here. I've read his stuff. Huge Matthew Wood fan. And then, like, it's a long personal experience. I don't consider myself a practicing herbalist at all. I think being a practicing herbalist is akin to being a doctor. There's years and years and decades of knowledge you need to really build up to be at that level. I have a working knowledge of the plants, like a very, you know, reasonable working knowledge of the plants. But I think, especially with herbalism, you have to learn these things through yourself. So I've been using herbs heavily for 5-6 years.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I thought was really cool when we were walking around was that you were telling me you're starting to learn to when to harvest and when it's right to harvest by the taste of the plant. And I think that's so incredible and underappreciated. A lot of times it's just like, oh yeah, it looks ready. Like, let's have it. But to actually be like tasting it and getting to that point where you're like, hey, I know this is ready. And out there you were telling me that Tulsi tastes like bubblegum. And so we were trying it and it was Tulsi that was going to seed versus what had been cut. And the taste was so different. And I don't know why, but I never would have thought about that. And have you always been trying to do this?
If you work with herbs, like, you really know you've got to harvest at the right time. And there's different ways of going about it. And I try to bring them all together. First of all, you have to understand where the energy is in the plant. For root crops, for example, you're going to want to harvest those in the fall once the top of the plant has gone dormant and it's put all its energy down into the roots. For your mint family plants, you want to harvest them generally when they're starting to flower. You know, it's put all its energy into this green top and it's pushing its energy up into the flowers. When it starts to have seed, then the energy is going to the seed and it's not as ideal for our use. So understanding, you know, what we're looking for in the plant and where the energy is in the plant. Then a lot of the, you know, working with herbs, you work with a lot of hippies. hippies are all, oh no, it's all about the moon. You know, what cycle is the moon in? And, you know, you're going to want to harvest your mint family plants, you know, right around the full moon or right after the full moon. And then the lab coat guys are like, you know, 20, 25% flower. You want to get it right there. What I do is I go out and I taste everything. That's like really the bottom line. And I'm really working on developing my senses for these plants and my knowledge of these plants. So I can go out and I taste peppermint and go, that's 60% as strong as it should be. Or it's 100%. Like, let's harvest it now. I'm rarely surprised. Almost always the moon cycle coincides with the flowering cycle, coincides with the taste. But for me, the bottom line is go out there and taste it. Sometimes yours.
That's something now that I'm going to probably become obsessed with.
Me too.
As someone who loves growing plants, like, I don't know why this has never come into my mind, but now I'm like, oh my God, like, I'm going to be tasting my stuff all the time. And it's cool that you notice, like, the moon cycles and stuff. Like, it's great if it all corresponds, but, like, to use taste in, like, your actual senses in that moment, I think is really powerful.
Little side note, I work with a bunch of beekeepers, and it's really cool to hear them talk about the natural world because they're in touch with the bees and they're in touch with what the bees are bringing back. So they know what's in bloom during every part of the year. And it's, it's by having the bees, it puts them in gives them a different perspective of the world. That's right. Very valuable.
Yeah. And so I know, especially having the herb farm here and having so many beautiful flowers, what are your thoughts on like the bees and the population of bees and saving the bees and what we can be doing and how like what you're doing here supports that, I guess?
So this farm is the Amish telephone booth for the local community. And many of the local Amish guys have gotten into beekeeping because everyone else's bees are collapsing. Their bees are collapsing too. It's just more labor and like there's a hole in the market because so many people are struggling. But yeah, bees on the whole are obviously going down.
Yes.
What people don't, I've had the good fortune of spending a little bit of time in primary rainforest. There's very, like, you know, just like native tall grass prairie, like 99.9% gone. The primary jungles in the world, primary rainforest, are like 99% gone. And this second growth forest that we see around here are these, you know, human-built prairies that we see. People don't realize, because they've never seen the real thing, how degraded they are. The forests here in the Driftless, I mean, we're lucky here that something like 50% of the land is in trees because it's so hilly, it just can't be put into crops. And people think these forests are the natural forest. It's so far from it. The trees and the soil and the ecosystems here aren't anything like they used to be. And everywhere in the whole world where the earth is good for planting, it's been basically destroyed by man. So the native habitats of these bees are gone. You think, you know, here used to be every inch of land was like great bee habitat. Now we have forests. There's some trees in the forest that support the pollinators. Some pasture that has some forbs in it that are good for the bees, but not that much. They mostly get beat up by the cattle. Compared to just this week, I was at the Prairie Moon Nursery Tour. And looking at, they have like 6 or 7 different treatments of their prairies up on the bluffs. And you see like maybe the native prairies look like this, or like this, or like this. And of course they look, you know, depends where you were. But the amount of bee food in the natural habitat is like infinitely more. But yeah, there's so many bees out here. Today we're harvesting anise hyssop. And anise hyssop is a plant everyone should have in their garden. It's tall, it gets above the weeds, and beautiful purple flowers. And it's in bloom almost all summer long. And there might have been 2 or 3 bees on every single plant. And then it's cool, as we work our way down the field, the bees kind of consolidate. So there might be 5 or 10 bees on every plant by the time we get to the end. I get honey from my neighbor here. He gives it to me because his bees are over here, you know, crashing my party all the time. And it's really great honey. And his bees have survived for the last few years. Keep your fingers crossed, though.
So you bring up another good point that I wanted to share was you're really doing everything with minimal tools and by hand, which is pretty unique, especially with as much area as you have here. Can you talk to that a little bit?
So this is the smallest farm I've ever worked on. Every other farm I've worked on or managed has, you know, 5 tractors. I just don't have capital for any tractors. My landlord just got tractored last week, so that'll probably alter me. But I do come from like a production farming background. You're doing 20 plus acres of vegetables. I'm not doing like 20 acres of pumpkins, but 20 acres of like lettuce and peppers. So my weeding systems, I have, you know, small hand tools, maybe $1,000 worth of little hand tools that are really precision and relatively quite fast. And what I lack for in speed and doing multiple rows at a time, I make up for somewhat in precision. My cultivating tools that are done by hand, push hoes and torsion weeders and things, are really precise. So I'm not going back and hardly doing any hand weeding. So that helps speed things up. But also, there was another thing. It was like, what can I do without all this equipment better? And it's by cutting the herbs by hand. I know everything that goes into it's perfect. And take tomorrow we'll be harvesting California poppy. Generally, that's, you know, you rip it up with tractors. But what I'm doing, because I don't have all that space, is I'm putting it as a in perennials that are going to fill up the row, fill up the fields. I'm putting it every other row, the California poppy. Now we come through the middle of August and harvest those and let the mints and other things take in the rest of the field. Instead of digging them up with big tractors and a lot of horsepower and just destroying the soil while we do that, we wait till we get a nice rain like this one, then we just pull the plants out. So it's not so much slower, and of course it's way more capital efficient.
Yeah.
And it's better, way better quality.
So you bring up California poppy. I've seen other poppy grow around here. It's gorgeous out there with poppy. What are some of the benefits to poppy? And I know you put it in your dream tea, right?
California poppy is the most potent herb I grow, and it's my favorite herb to grow. It does really well here. Our winters, our summers aren't so different from Southern California winters. Last winter, I went down to Southern California and looked at one of the large California poppy reserves. It was a really special treat for me to see how that plant grows in its native habitat. And I'm trying to mimic that as much as possible. I'm sure that California poppy has a symbiotic relationship with microbes in the soil. So I grabbed a bunch of dirt from the reserve in California, and then I inoculated my seeds with it here before I planted them. And I did that in some areas, and other areas I didn't. And the areas where I inoculated the seed with the California dirt, I think I'm seeing better growth, thicker roots and deeper, and we got a little different look to them too, of something that's not actually the California poppy, but it's, you know, it's symbiotic friend. California poppy is very sedative. It doesn't have the morphine in it that your opium poppy, also same poppy as your poppy seeds or your poppy seed bagel, that's the same as your heroin poppy. My poppy is a different poppy. It's native to California. Distantly related. The California poppy is totally non-addictive, totally non-narcotic, and totally legal. But you drink it and you definitely know you had a cup as well. It's way more potent than chamomile or things you'll find in your other bedtime teas. And the root, I believe, is the most potent part. I harvest the whole plant, different parts of, it doesn't matter what herb it is, different parts of the plants will have different compounds in them. So I harvest the whole plant, but really focus on getting as much root and tea as I can. And I never water my California poppy. It's from a dry area, and I try to grow it as much like it grows in its native environment as possible. It's really relaxing. So it's very good for sleep right before bed. It metabolizes pretty quickly. So it won't keep you asleep for 12 hours or even 10 hours. But to kind of relax the body and prepare for sleep, it's great. Also, in the middle of the day, it's very effective for anxiety. Ooh. So, like, boss is yelling at you, or you know, your kids are monsters, cup of California poppy tea or dream tea, and really just kind of helps take that.
You're growing some adaptogens, too. And can you talk about that? I know we were checking out ashwagandha out there and Tulsi. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about how or why you decided to do adaptogens? And also, P.S., I'm impressed that they grow in Wisconsin.
The three adaptogens are the ashwagandha, the Tulsi, and then I also buy in ginseng. Wisconsin's the largest producer of the ginseng in this country by a lot. And it's funny, you know, the ashwagandha, it's one of the best things for energy there is. It's also one of the best things for sleep. you know, a lot of the adaptogenic herbs too are roots. Mm-hmm. Tulsi is the only one I can think of off the top of my head. It might be the only adaptogenic herb that's a leaf or considered adaptogenic. I'm not sure if, you know, the tulsi is grounding. So it's good for energy and it's good for relaxing, but I'm not sure if it's adaptogenic in the same way that, like the ashwagandha or the ginseng would be. Mm-hmm. And then the ginseng, the American ginseng is, more subtle. The Asian ginseng, the Chinese ginseng is more buzzy, more like caffeine, or, and you don't want to consume the Asian ginseng every day, where the American ginseng, you can consume it every day as a tonic to help restore whatever you need.
I know you said the majority of what you put in your teas, you do grow here on site. There's just a few things you buy out. And Wisconsin ginseng, it grows wild around here too, right? And that's so mostly if you see like American ginseng, it would be like Wisconsin ginseng. Is that
correct?
True, right?
We're at kind of the northern edge, not right at the edge, but we're definitely pretty far north as far as ginseng's native range goes. But yeah, most of the ginseng, 95% of the ginseng grown in this country grows in Wisconsin. They actually wild harvest more ginseng from my neighborhood than they do in Marathon, where it's all grown. And because I buy, you know, a lot of ginseng for my teas, I went out there to check out the farm I get it from and got the Royal VIP tour and I asked him, why is everyone growing ginseng here and no one growing it, you know, in my county, in Buffalo County? He goes, well, just because everyone started growing it here and that's where it took off. But he's sure that it would grow great in my soil and my farm. So I've actually planted, oh, I shouldn't say this in front of people. I've planted thousands of ginseng seeds in the forest here.
Cool.
But I don't know too many people have been successful with that. We'll see what comes up. The ginseng I buy for the teas is the standard cultivated 3- and 4-year-old ginseng. They say that has like 70% of the potency of the 10-year-old wild grown ginseng. At least that's what the lab tests say. But I'm growing the 10-year-old wild stuff that sells for $1,000 a pound. And if I get anything great, not likelihood the neighbor will get it.
That brings up another point is, so most of what you're growing is perennial, but they're not something that you, not everything, it's something that you can harvest every year. Because sometimes you're harvesting the root too. And so it's taking 4 or 5 years. Is that right?
So the only thing, well, the main thing I'm growing that I can't harvest straight away is echinacea.
Okay.
The most potent echinacea you harvest in the 4th year. I actually wanted to, echinacea you can either harvest just the root in the fall of the 4th year, or you can harvest the whole plant. I want to harvest the whole plant. Like I said before, different parts of the plant have different compounds. And I'm not really geared up to do roots. So I'm geared up to do plant tops. So that's kind of what I want to focus on. And the roots a little bonus. So I was out there in, say, middle of June, smelling and tasting the echinacea breaking off leaves. It was like a wet, more succulent plant, and it was so potently aromatic. I didn't even know echinacea could get like that.
Really?
But I didn't get around to harvesting it, and by the time I was ready to harvest it, the plant was much drier. You break it, and you smell it. It just wasn't nearly the same. So now the echinacea harvest is postponed until this fall.
Okay.
And I'll dig up the roots and just put the roots in the teas. I'm actually working on growing echinacea, not through transplants like I've done in my earlier plantings, but actually through more of a prairie setup. Echinacea is a native prairie plant. And the best medicine is going to come from like a wild grown echinacea. That's what I mimic in those fields. But my new echinacea fields, I'm actually like growing it out in the pasture. And the horses go out there and they keep down the weeds around the echinacea. And yeah, that's kind of what I'm moving towards every time more, is like really native wild plantings, like legitimate wild plantings as much as possible, as opposed to just mimicking, which is way better than most.
But yeah. Oh my gosh. I love how this keeps evolving. Like, yeah. I feel like you just keep changing, and just kind of like nature keeps changing.
I'm a big believer that success comes from always learning. I definitely don't want to do the same thing now in 5 years. Like every year I want to learn more and more and keep that super steep learning curve. Just always learning as much each year as I did the year before. reason I've gone into this small scale sustainable agriculture is because I'll never be done learning. My mentor, Paul, who I work with, he'd been farming 70 years and he'd say, oh, I might be like a second grader or a third grader in these things, you know, recognizing that there's just so much to learn.
Let's talk about one of your teas. It's called Angel, and it's one of my favorites. It has nettle in there and milky oats and I think beets even, mm-hmm. right? And so can you talk about how you kind of came up with that and like why those components? Mm-hmm.
So Angel is soothing and nourishing. And I picked that combination of traits because everyone needs something that's soothing and nourishing. Nettles grow better here. So almost every herb farm in the country is on the coast, but nettle grows better here, grows best here. Nettle's just around wild, like crazy here. So I harvest all, this is Wolf Valley. I harvest the next three farms up are all friends of mine, and they let me wild harvest on the edge of their fields and the edge of their pastures and around. So the last couple of years, I've put up about 200 pounds of dried nettle leaf each year. It's like premium quality, wild crafted stuff. And I enjoy doing it, and it's the best quality nettle you can get.
Yeah.
So nettle is an ingredient I have a lot of. Oats are another thing, one of the things I do the most of. So milky oats are just your normal oats that are harvested before they're mature. And the constituents in the oat changes dramatically as the seed matures up. So most herb farms and most oats that you can buy are oat straw. They cut the whole top of the plant. But plants, especially your annual plants, they put all their energy into the seed. I'm not interested in the whole top of the plant. I just want the seed where, you know, all the real energy is going to. And then we harvest those when they're nice and milky. My Amish neighbors actually grow them for horse feed. And I contract with them and I get in there before they do. And I harvest their oats. And then I gave my neighbor here, we harvested 300 pounds of milky oats out of his farm. And I gave him $600. And he was just laughing at me, think I was the dumbest man alive. But, you know, it's one of the more efficient things I do, and it's like guaranteed because I've got a couple neighbors to rely on for it. And I'm happy to share in any success I can have with that.
Cool.
And oats are great. They taste great, and they're supposed to be one of the most nourishing things for the nervous system. So my teas are strong in oat. It also has fennel, a blend of mints, calendula flowers, which I pick off one at a time. A lemon balm, which is delicious and soothing. Apples for flavor. Beets. Every year I say I want to get more beets in my life.
Yeah.
Beets are so mineral rich, like the nettles, different minerals. And so I put a little beets in my tea. It gives it this beautiful little ruby red color, but also helps people get the minerals they need in their everyday.
That's amazing. And I think nettles are known for being pretty mineral rich as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. The amount of minerals a plant has is directly related to how big the root system is. Nettles are almost like trees. They have tremendous root systems, and they're perennial that's able to access minerals from wide, far and away. Here's a little side note on nettles. A lot of the nettles I cut have pink stems. On the inside, they're pink. Some of them are hollow. Depending where you harvest from. The only thing I've seen in nature, the same pink color, is the inside of the nitrogen-fixing bacteria. I'm quite sure that this pink you see inside the nettle stem is not nettle, but it's some sort of fungus, maybe, or a bacteria that is in symbiosis with the nettle plants.
Oh, cool.
And I think that's one reason why the nettles are so such powerful growers is that they have this symbiotic relationship with whatever's pink inside the hollow stems.
So that brings up a really interesting point about the microbiome and like our own kind of ecology as far as that goes. But then that of the soil and like the earth and all the living species in the soil. And I know that's a passion of yours.
We inoculated the California poppy seed with soil from like where California poppies grow, thrive in the wild, in the best places. And then the biodiversity above ground leading to biodiversity below. We can talk about that. But the number one thing you can do is not mess it up. Tillage is so destructive. So really minimize the tillage. It's important for what I do to, I'm all the fields I'm breaking into were in pasture, basically in quack grass, which is very aggressive grass that is very hard to kill. It takes a lot of tillage to remove the quack grass to start. I do have to grow plants. I can't just have quack grass everywhere. So I do have to very aggressively till for a while to remove the quack grass. But then I cover crop. And the cover crops, you can till those into the soil when they're still green and they're lush. And that they disappear just like that in a few weeks. And that's food for the microbiology. When plants get more brown, more older, and more stiff, more like wood, they take longer to break down. But when you enter, which is good for organic matter in the soil, and that's also critical. But when you inject all this green, lush matter into the soil, it decomposes really quickly, and there's an explosion of microbial life. So if I do have to destroy the soil through tillage, try to get a round of that really green manure in there to repopulate the soil with microbes. Also, I buy in like a dump truck of compost every year.
Okay.
And the compost, first of all, it's inoculated with all these microbiological. But also, the key for the compost for me is it's like just straight microbe food. And as it breaks down, it, you know, gives life to the microbes in the soil, which in turn feeds.
So as far as kind of some of your favorites go and stuff that grows around here, what are maybe your top five favorite herbs that you grow?
California poppies right at the top of the list. Ashwagandha, I trialed it last year and it worked out really well. So we're doing that a little bit more full on this year. I'm having great success with it and I really am enjoying ashwagandha. Tulsi is a great one. The nettles are great. I have some different mints that I grow. I've tried five different types of spearmint out here, including spearmint that I kind of pilfered from the Wrigley Spearmint Farm in Oregon and some other varieties. Now I'm set on the Scotch mint variety. It's so good. Most of the spearmints taste a little bit like cat pee or smell a little bit like cat pee. The Scotch mint doesn't. It's just like 100% delicious. I have a variety of three varieties of peppermint. I've settled on a particular strain of chocolate mint that I like very much. I'm trialing tea maker hops. So it's a variety of hops that's less bitter.
Okay.
And anyway, I'm actually growing a nursery bed of it this year for the rhizomes, and I think that'll make it in the tea in a couple.
That'd be like in a sleepy, like yeah, a night.
As you know,
like
the hops are mildly sedative.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful. And this variety of, I've tried some. They make a very lovely cup of tea.
Nice. So how did you come up with your blend?
You know, the first and foremost, this is a farm. I produce the teas because I need a product to sell. But my passion is growing the best quality herbs. So the first year I tried all these different herbs. And then at the end of the year I had, I think after my first year, 800 pounds of dried herbs. And I had to figure out, okay, let's put some blends together. I thought it was going to take, you know, a week. Oh my goodness, it took me 3 months. And the Angel blend took me 300 iterations to get the flavor just right. And I have 1/100 of a gram scale in that closet. There is my tea lab. I have probably 100 different types of herbs and all sorts of funny little extras like apple bits and maple syrup crystals and honey powder and you know, all these specialty ingredients. So I can go and then I have notebooks and notebooks and notebooks filled with all these different current and future blends. And I'll make a cup of tea with, you know, my 1/100 of a gram scale, and, you know, a pinch of that and 0.06 grams of the other. And then I'll drink the tea and then I'll take notes. Oh, it needs more of this, less of that. And the next day I'll come back and I'll blend the new recipe with my new advice. And then I'll taste that, and then I'll make a new notes. And it to make a good cup of tea is easy. But to make a really stellar, excellent cup of tea takes a lot of work.
What do you tell people? Like, how should they be brewing tea? Like, what's the best way to go about it?
So my teas are whole leaf herbal teas, and they're different than every other type of tea. You know, your black teas and your green teas, they can become bitter if they're in the water too long, if the water's too hot. But really, for these medicinal herbal teas, we're trying to extract as much out of the leaves as possible. On the flip side, with a lot of these aromatic herbs, if it's too long and too hot, the mint flavors and a lot of aromatics will dissipate off. So I recommend a tablespoon of herbs with 12 ounces of boiling water and let it steep for 7 minutes.
Okay.
With the angel tea, it's excellent iced. You can brew it double strong and then add half ice. And then all of these, you can leave them longer, but I think that 7 minutes is really kind of the ideal.
I love tea and like the whole ritual of having tea as well.
Me too.
And one of the things you brought up was like that part of like the farm and everything is slowing down and like doing it right and appreciating kind of the moment you're in. Can you speak to that?
Well, not this week. what I do here, if making money were my number one goal, I would have chosen anything else first. I really love what I do. I love working with the plants and working with the land. I love walking around and looking at the plants grow and, you know, taking the time to really understand in detail every row of all the fields. I'm also a big believer in being still and taking time to meditate and sit out here with my cup of tea and actively not think. I harvest the calendula flowers. I have a 700-foot row of calendula four plants wide. It takes about an hour and a half to harvest. And every time I harvest calendula, I go in there with the intention of doing it with a very still mind. I love my yoga and my meditation and my still time, but oh, this time of year, there's so much going on. Not only, I've got like 3 full-time jobs right now. I've got, production, I've got sales, I've got marketing, I have packaging. There were 130 people out of the farm last week on farm tours.
Last week
is my busiest week of the year. And then on Monday morning, we got a surprise inspection from the FDA. He goes, "Do you have a minute?" And I'm thinking about my to-do list. There's just like no way to do it. "Do you have a minute?" "For you, sir?" "Of course." That was 2 days.
Oh my God.
So right now, specifically, I'm a little more jittery and wound up. To take time for yourself and to do the things you most enjoy doing, it's really special. One thing I love about being a farmer or being any self-employed job is you get to control your schedule.
Yeah.
And that is so valuable. So while I work really hard and put in way more than 60 hours each week, I got back yesterday from spending the day with my nephew in Minneapolis, who's 2 years old. I'm planning a 3-day, 2-night canoe trip for middle of September. I ride horses, 3 days a week. And again, being with horses is the ultimate in being still and connecting with another creature. I'm all about that.
Yeah.
Go, go, go and work, but also gotta have the calm.
Yeah, finding that balance. And it totally makes sense that sometimes you got enough work to do that you probably don't have the stillness, but when you can, and that's right now, just sitting here watching the horses is like so peaceful. I think you have one of the nicest setups here.
Thank you.
Just can't get over how beautiful it is.
Yeah, and I also love that my work is seasonal.
Yeah.
Every week is different than the week before. And during the winter, I have a lot of downtime. This winter, I'm going to take off 2 months. I'm going to go travel. I don't even know where I'm going yet.
Oh, cool.
But, I think it's really important to come back with fully recharged batteries. My little kitten is just attacking me like crazy.
I was gonna say, I am so impressed that you're able to continue talking while being attacked.
Oh, I've named it Tiger after my tea, but look at this little red kitten, the little striped kitten is just like all claws and teeth.
Oh my goodness.
Cute little thing.
Yeah, it was just climbing the screens a little bit ago. And then it went into attack mode. So one of the questions I ask everybody, towards the end, is what does nourish really mean to you?
I'm going to go back to my mentor, Paul. He was a huge believer that, not all plants are the same. Not all eggplants are the same. Not all lettuces are the same. On the farm I worked with him on, he had been on that land for 30 plus years and had spend a small fortune mineralizing the soil. And he would say, if the minerals aren't in the soil, they won't get in the plant. If they don't get in the plant, they don't get into you. So it's not just about eating the right types of foods, but eating foods that were grown right and really do have that mineral density. On side note, that farm I was on in Minnesota, Paul's farm, we had an independent berry consultant who would go travel around the country testing the bricks on strawberries. And our bricks on that farm were the highest bricks he had seen anywhere on this side of the Rocky Mountains, which was a testament. Bricks is the amount of dissolved solids in something. And that's basically the amount of sugars in it.
Okay.
And the more dissolved solids relates directly to how much minerals are in the plant, how much minerals are in the soil. So, getting the right foods, but also the right grown foods. And especially with the herbs, a California poppy that's grown with all the water and all the fertilizer and all the space is not the same that one that grows in the biologically active with little struggle and more slowly.
Nourishing foods, there's such a spectrum, right? And like the energy of the plants that are grown wild and like in kind of a more natural habitat versus those that are cultivated is totally different. So any last words of wisdom before we wrap up?
I hope everyone who listens gets to try my teas and enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will link everything up in the show notes so that you can find his amazing teas. And you sell them online, and you said 80 grocery stores as well, right?
Right.
Yep. Awesome. So I'll put a link to your website. You also are on Facebook. Like I said, my favorite is Angel, but they are all so good. Right now we're drinking Tiger, right?
Right. Tiger, I've been going like double, triple hard lately. And Tiger is good for like a grounded, focused energy, but it won't keep you up like coffee. I'm drinking it now. It's at 7 at night, and it's just very restorative. So it's good for energy, but it won't keep you up. It helps kind of rebuild after these stressful, hard days.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being with me on Nourish and Shine. It has been an absolute pleasure. And this has been so much fun that I was able to come out here and check out this amazing farm that is just blowing me away. I know I took a million pictures, so I'll definitely post them so that everyone can see how awesome this place is.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you too, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Nourish and Shine. I hope that you enjoy this episode and that you'll leave me a review on iTunes so that more people can hear the podcast. I'd also love to connect with you on social media. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I would love to hear your questions, so please send them my way. Also, you can check out my website. It's amysopola.com. I hope that today's interview provided you with some inspiration and practical advice to nourish your mind, body, and spirit, optimize your health, and to live a whole, vibrant life. Please join me again next week for another amazing interview. Have a wonderful week. The information provided on this podcast is for educational purposes only. It's not intended to diagnose or treat any disease or condition. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your medical provider.